Welcome to Weekly Insights at Winthrop Capital Management, where we discuss recent developments currently shaping the markets and industries in the global economy. Here's your host, Chief Investment Officer Greg Hahn.
Good morning, everybody. Happy President's Day. Where to start? So today we're going to cover a little bit of what's going on in the economy and the Fed monetary program that's creeping up on us. Talk a little bit about what's going on in the markets, and then cover the second half of the income part of this. So with that, let's kick it off. So let me cover the economy and the monetary policy, and then I'll kick it over to Freddie. So the global economy right now is obviously severely impacted by the coronavirus that's spreading from China. So if you're following what's going on, China is actually closing down cities. I'm going to botch the pronunciation here, but Wuhan and Chengdu are cities that are effectively shut down, but the list goes on. And then, you know, there's stories of kids going back to school. Now they were hoping all businesses would be open February 10th, then it got extended. Now it's school opens in mid-March. But the hard part's going to be the manufacturing industry that China has. It's so shut down that getting it going again is going to be a huge task. And what we're hearing is to reopen a business requires approval from municipal health officials, and they have to check the travel history of every employee in order for it to get turned back on or certified to get back to work. So it's a major effort to restart China's manufacturing sector. Obviously, this has an impact on global trade. So we're going to see, this is not in the numbers yet. This is the concern, is that the first quarter numbers, both globally and domestic, are going to be impacted not only by the coronavirus, but also the production halt of the 737 MAX, which is not, we would tell you, not in the manufacturing numbers. So the corollary in the market appears to be attached to positive measures in consumer spending and the labor market. So we saw retail sales were up in January by 0.3%, which is the offset that we saw to the decline in industrial production last month of 0.3%. But it appears that the capital markets are really attached to positive news in the consumer sector, which obviously is the largest part of our domestic economy. But the blind spot right now, and this is where we have some concerns, is that the economic numbers don't reflect the headwinds that are the pullback in the manufacturing as a result of the spreading coronavirus, and also the production halt on the 737 MAX. So the downside risk, this is a macro theme, but the downside risk is pretty severe would warrant a kind of a risk-off type of mentality, or reducing risk in the portfolio. That includes shifting out of large cap domestic growth, as well as international equity, and going long treasuries in portfolios with the expectation that slowing growth is going to be a decline in interest rates. However, the offset to this is really interesting, is the growth in the Fed's balance sheet. So the Fed has very quietly started buying back treasuries. So the increase in banks in the reserve bank credit on the balance sheet number is over 20% in the last 3 months, and it's a huge buying program, which is a financial stimulus right now in the marketplace. And I think all indications, Adam, are that the Fed's going to continue to be buying.
Yeah, I mean, the repo market's been pretty fragile. And I mean, I think we all would agree that once the Fed steps into a program, it's kind of hard for them to pull back. So they keep extending the terms of their interest in the repo. Right now, it's all the way out to June.
Yeah. And I think this is modern monetary policy is going to be a Fed balance sheet. It has less to do with the little tweaks in short-term interest rates, which we could argue whether that's effective or not. But man, when the Fed starts buying securities in the open market, it's a powerful stimulus, which this is a whole separate topic, but gets to how the financial system works, and the machine that's there is it works. We would maintain that it works differently today because of these buying programs, and that the bond market effectively is a tool for corporate America to refinance its debt. It has less to do with credit extension as much as it do to support financial engineering which then supports, in some warped way, economic growth through increased profitability in the stock market. So that's a longer discussion, a bit of a tangent, but we need to have that at some point. But with that, let me turn it over to Freddie.
Thanks, Greg. So just to provide a quick summary on equities last week, the S&P was up 1.5% to continue all-time high runs. So year-to-date, gains are now 4.62%. And we're halfway through fourth quarter earnings. Estimates have improved from the initial projection of a 30 basis point decline. Growth is estimated to be 2.3% now, with 71% of S&P companies reporting above their estimates. Growth so far has been driven by communication services and tech. And to circle back from last week, Google reported earnings, $15.35 a share, which is up 20%. Revenue was $46 billion, and that missed estimate. So that's the first FANG stock to actually miss, although growth was still 17%. And the interesting thing about this quarter was this is the first time that Google has broken up numbers for YouTube and cloud. So YouTube ad revenue generated $15.2 billion in revenue, which is 36% growth year over year. And they did still keep it limited, making it kind of hard to gauge profitability. They didn't report the percentage of ad revenue that actually goes to the creators, but it is still something. And looking at cloud business, they had $8.92 billion in revenue in 2019. So that's 53% growth year over year. And that is, although that seems high compared to Azure from Microsoft, which is much bigger, and they did 62% in growth, it is still lagging. But it is much newer, the cloud game, compared to AWS and Azure. So the stock was down on the earnings release 3%. But we do like Google here, and it still continues to be one of our top holdings. So that's all I had on equities.
Okay, so yeah, and fixed income, we're going to talk a little bit about income specifically, how to get it into your portfolio, how it creates a more defensive position. I think the obvious nature is that income offsets any price action, so it can lower volatility in the bond world. It shortens duration the higher your coupon is. So just an important aspect to look at as we're talking about moving more defensively. And as Greg was talking about, with interest rates low and the outlook that they could go even lower, you've got negative interest rates across Europe. Italian bonds are even negative. Japanese curve is negative. So where do you go for income? If economic growth is low, interest rates are going to stay low. If you look at demographics, there's not a strong case for them to go up either. So if you look at right now across developed countries, there's over 300 million people over 65, and that's growing at a rate of 10,000 per day net. That's assuming people don't start to live longer, which I think is doubtful. You'll have 400 million people over 65 in the next 10 years. So you've got a lot of individuals who are going to be looking at income. If you're a financial advisor, not to call it boilerplate, but when people turn 65, what do? You tell them they need to start buying more bonds. So that's going to put even more pressure on treasury yields. So it's difficult to find a place for income. One place that we've noticed a lot of investors starting to turn their attention towards are levered loans and the CLO market. What these are bank loans to smaller, lower credit profile companies that should turn a higher return. You're looking at a lot of double B, single B, and some triple C firms. The problem is, even in that market, you're not really getting a whole lot for the risk you're taking. I would argue that these are riskier loans than the public high yield market. And the levered loan index, this is the S&P's levered loan index, right now pays a yield of 5.57%.
And so the CLO market is largely an institutional market.
It is.
So if you're a financial advisor, you can't really go out and say, I'm going to put a slice of my client's assets into a CLO.
Cannot.
So what's the alternative?
So the alternative, there are levered loan mutual funds out there now. So you could get access here. I'm seeing some structured product come that has this in it as well.
Structured notes,
yes. So there are ways to get involved. Really, I want to bring it up as a way to, because you're probably going to get questions from your clients.
So how does that differ from a BDC than a business development company?
From my viewpoint, the biggest difference in a BDC is kind of the back end way of getting some of these higher or lower rated bonds. The biggest difference is in the leveraged loan market is everything is secured. My understanding of the BDC market is a lot of that is unsecured debt.
The BDC also itself is levered 50%.
Yes.
It can lever that up 50%. So that's the leverage is not necessarily in the CLO where you tranche the security, but in the BDC where you're buying equity in the business development company itself, that has a 50%, up to a 50% leverage ratio. So the debt would be, we see that the debt's investment grade on a lot of this stuff like the KKR, BDC, Franklin Square. It's very, very volatile.
Yeah. One big difference as well in the BDCs are after Dodd-Frank is that CLO managers are required to retain, the managers themselves retain 5%, at least 5% of the equity themselves. BDCs do not have that stipulation. So CLO managers do have a little more skin in the game. But one of the things, this would apply to BDCs as well, is we're seeing the number of cov-lite loans increase dramatically. So if you look back to 2010, roughly 20% of levered loans were cov-lite. Now it's over 80%. And basically what this means, you hear this term thrown around a lot, is that a cov-lite loan means that there's no maintenance on it. So basically, whatever the covenants are, whatever the metrics are at the time of issue, as long as you hit those, you're fine. No one looks at them again. They don't have to be maintained. If it's not a cov-lite, they have to maintain those leverage ratios or whatever the other ratios that are stipulated within the covenants. So to have so many loans out there where really the covenants aren't being looked after is a big risk.
So what's a yield right now? Do you know what the yield is on the BDC? I haven't.
It really depends on the BDC and what leverage it has, but I mean, I've seen some in the 7%.
So where are we in the credit cycle? Because a lot of this is really predicated on a shift in the credit cycle. So we go through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and we would there would be the cov-lite loan was a leading indicator of a shift in the credit cycle. But we've been on this extended run in credit, where low interest rates has afforded companies to refinance their debt. So the liquidity squeeze that normally comes through a credit cycle of trying to have or having to refinance your short term debt coming due and being squeezed if you can't access the credit market to do it is pretty much, I mean, it's a rare thing now.
Yeah.
Except potentially in the energy space and retail. I mean, those very knowable sectors where there are problems and they're idiosyncratic in some cases, but you're looking at, we're not really seeing an increase in non-performing loans in the banking sector. We're not seeing this deterioration in credit across the board like we would typically have seen. And this is all, I mean, we're, what, 11 years out from the financial crisis. So
I think low rates are going to keep the cycle extended because that's why we're seeing such low default rates, because it is easy to refinance. I mean, it seems like every time you turn around, the rates are lower. So, like, hey, I can refi lower. So until rates are higher, I think you don't see a real blow up.
Charlie, what's your take?
I mean, at this point, there's so much demand for new debt here. So, like, you're seeing, like, really kind of shoddy energy companies, neighbors, industries that normally should never be able to go out and refinance their existing debt. But people will buy it because that's where you can get yield. So I don't see how that stops in the short term.
Yeah, one of the subtle issues with this whole coronavirus and what's going on in China is the surge in the U.S. dollar. So the surge in the U.S. dollar is really backed by foreign buyers of U.S. assets, and it's all U.S. assets. It's equities, it's bonds. And I think in some regard, that's probably helping support the credit markets as well. Because
yeah.
If you look, you mentioned Italy, if your choice is negative yields in Italy, let's go to the U.S. and at least we can find some income, because you don't have those alternatives necessarily in Europe or other developed markets. So what would you do? Wait, before you answer that, so tell me again where you took your girlfriend for Valentine's Day. It had the word supper club.
It did. And that was a little strange when I was talking to my grandparents. They were like, supper club, that reminds me of Wisconsin back
right
in the day.
Right on.
And it was not like that. It was a place called Geraldine Supper Club in Fountain Square here in Indianapolis.
And on Charlie's 5-star rating, what category would you give it?
I'll give it a strong 4.
All right.
I'm usually a little tough. My steak was probably a little undercooked, but
okay, back to income.
That
now.
Was it. Yeah, sorry. So just a quick note. So for wealth management clients that benefit from added income, but either don't have the space or for whatever other reason, don't have the capacity to own individual bonds, there's a couple different options. I'm a high yield guy, so I will start there. There's high yield bond ETFs, and there's also closed end high yield funds. I'm going to discuss some of the advantages to both. In ETFs, the most popular tickers are JNK and HYG. These ETFs offer a cheap way to invest in high yield funds, but they come with a few different drawbacks. So this, the SPDR Bloomberg Barclays high yield bond ETF ticker JNK tracks the high yield very liquid index. The ETF has 12-month yield of 5.46% and carries a relatively inexpensive expense ratio at 40 bips. Ticker HYG is very similar metrics. So these funds carry the risk of being high yield indexing funds. So they have broad exposure to all high yield qualities from the relatively safer double Bs to the high risk triple C tranche. But you're going to get a fund that is pretty indicative of the current market. On the other hand, there's closed-end high-yield funds, such as the BlackRock Corporate High Yield Fund, ticker HYT. This fund adds far greater yield than the ETFs, but does introduce additional leveraging risk and are much more expensive. HYT has a 12-month yield of 7.69%. So that's more than 2%, more than what the ETFs carry. But they have 154 bips expense ratio and is almost 30% leveraged. The Western Asset High Yield Income Fund, ticker HYX, very similar, has the most expensive ratio at 2%, but gives off a yield north of 8%. So the use of leverage in these closed-end funds introduces more volatility than what you'd get out of an ETF. Investors may also realize less liquidity if they wanted to add or trim to their position in these funds. But you also get the advantage of having the portfolio actively managed, so managers can pick and choose their spots, whereas these ETFs, you do not get that. And then a last important note on closed-end funds, because these funds are issued similarly to an IPO, there's no new shares ever created. These funds often trade at a premium or discount to their underlying assets. So this can add more risk to investing in a closed-end fund, but can also provide attractive or unattractive entry points to investment. IG land, the basic rules still really apply. You take a look at ticker AGG, which is the ETF. That's a 2.5% distribution with a very low expense ratio of 5 bips. BlackRock Core Bond Trust, ticker BHK, has a 12-month yield of north of 5% and leverage about 30%. So that BlackRock fund offers a yield similar to high-yield ETFs, but replaces the volatility from underlying credit risk to leveraging risk there.
So I want to we're running a little bit long, but I want to hit Kraft Heinz. But before we do that, the way the math works, and it is after 9 o'clock, so we can talk about math on a Monday morning. But the closed-end fund can leverage up to 40%. An open-end fund actually technically can lever up to 15%, but most don't lever. But if your borrowing cost is 1%, and you're investing in a pool of assets, particularly high yield assets that yield 5.5%, your net carry is 4.5%. So the math allows, if you put that on 40% of the portfolio, the income flowing through that portfolio allows managers to take out excess fees, pass it on to the client. The client gets a great return, but it's a levered return. So leverage is a double-edged sword. It's working right now in a period of low interest rates and stable credit spreads. The concern, though, is if we see that shift in the credit market, it works against you. Before we close, let's talk very, very briefly about Kraft Heinz. Last week, bonds were off significantly. What happened, Adam?
So earnings came out. That was the first thing. Free cash flow went negative. You're seeing pricing pressure. Costs are going up from wages. And you're seeing the prices of their products come down. So significant pressure on earnings and free cash flow put pressure on the bonds. They started to widen out. And the next day, Fitch came out and downgraded them to a double B. Which made the bonds gap out even more. So you saw bonds on the long end 80 basis points wider. They were off at least 5 points. In some places, they were down even 10 points at some part of the day on that downgrade. You saw Moody's come in and reaffirm a triple B minus. So you saw the bonds kind of firm up a little bit. But overall, you've got a company that is struggling to find buyers in the millennial camp. Those type of people that are looking for the organic ketchups and the
eating macaroni and cheese.
Right. The Easy Mac is going away. Just to reiterate, though, is
they have kids.
Berkshire Hathaway is a large holder of Kraft, both in debt and equity.
And the S&P actually downgraded them to double B plus.
They did get downgraded.
So I don't know if they have like an Egan Jones rating on it, but this might already be technically high yield now.
And what did we do?
We bought bonds as things were kind of unraveling. Bought them at 283 off the long bond. Just to give context, prior day they were at 215.
All right, you guys, we're going to have to shut this down. We went long today. You guys have a great week. Thank you.
All investments are subject to risk, including the possible loss of the money you invest. The information presented in this podcast is intended for educational purposes only and does not take into consideration your personal circumstances or other factors that may be important in making investment decisions. You may access and download this podcast only for your personal and non-commercial use. You may not use it in any other manner or for any other purpose without Winthrop's written permission. Copyright 2020, Winthrop Capital Management, LLC. All rights reserved.